This is the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Doug Nadvornik.
This time we're on record in Nate versus Denny.
That's Idaho Supreme Court Chief Justice Roger Burdick opening this morning's proceedings in Boise in a case brought by 30 state legislators, including Rexburg Republican Ronald Nate, against Secretary of State Lawrence Denny. The case involves Governor Butch Otter's veto after this year's legislative session of a bill that would have repealed Idaho's grocery tax. Nate and his colleagues argue Otter was a day late with his veto and the repeal should automatically become law. Secretary of State Denny was named in the suit because he was the state official who accepted the governor's veto. The legislator's attorney is Brian Smith.
We're asking this court to go back 39 years ago and reconsider a ruling from this court. Now, the judges are different, the times are different, but that's really what we're asking.
The case to which Smith refers was Santa Rosa versus Andrus. It was decided by the Supreme Court in 1978. Then Secretary of State Pete Santa Rosa challenged a veto by then Governor Cecil Andrus, and the court ruled in a close decision, 3-2, that after a legislative session ends, the governor has 10 days from the time he receives the bill to sign it or veto it. Smith argues that was a misinterpretation. He argues the state constitution clearly says the governor has 10 days from the end of the legislative session, not when he receives the bill. In this case, that's only one day, but a very important one. Because the legislature had already adjourned and because only the governor can call lawmakers back into special session, there was no opportunity to override his veto. Brian Smith asked the current justices to vacate the 1978 ruling and declare the governor's veto on the grocery tax repeal bill void.
The goal of this court is to safeguard and uphold the Constitution of the state of Idaho. That's what the goal should be, and that's what it is. And for those reasons, if the court does not apply a reversal, if the court were to reverse Santa Rosa in this case to this case, that goal would not be accomplished. Because what would happen is the court would be saying, well, yes, the Constitution is plain and unambiguous and clear, and this is what it says, but we're not going to apply it in this case.
The attorneys for Secretary of State Denny and Governor Otter made several rebuttal points. One, doesn't matter whether the court's interpretation in 1978 was right or wrong, its ruling is the current state law. This is Deputy Attorney General Brian Kane.
We just heard minutes ago counsel acknowledge Secretary Denny was required to file the veto. He fulfilled his clear legal duty at the time that this case was filed.
Otter's attorney, David Hensley, argued the legislators didn't have proper legal standing to file this lawsuit. He says they weren't harmed by the governor's veto. He was challenged by Justice Robin Brody.
So who has standing to bring this case, if not the petitioners?
Justice Brody, I believe that a grocery store owner in a border community who would be at a competitive disadvantage would have standing to bring a declaratory judgment action to question the wisdom of Santa Rosa to challenge the governor's veto.
And finally, Hensley and Kane questioned whether this case should have gone directly to the state Supreme Court, bypassing the district court system. Brian Smith, the legislator's attorney, answered there was no need for that because the decision in question was made by the Supreme Court and it should be the body to reconsider it. After an hour's worth of oral arguments, the court took the case under advisement and will issue an opinion later. Our thanks to Idaho Public Television, which provided the audio feed of this proceeding. And now we cross the border into Washington to talk with State School Superintendent Chris Rakedahl. During the next 2 weeks, we're going to hear plenty in the news about the progress, or lack of, that Washington's legislative leaders are making in writing a new state budget. June 30th is the end of the state's fiscal year. If there's no budget, there's no money, and the government will have to cut back to the most basic services. Most of the state budget goes to K-12 education, and you've probably heard reference to something called McCleary. That's the name of the plaintiff in an education funding lawsuit that went to the state Supreme Court. We asked the state's new school superintendent, Chris Rakedahl, to tell us what he thinks parents and taxpayers think McCleary really means.
I think there's a big misconception. I think the average parent says, McCleary means they're going to finally start fully funding our schools. That's not actually what the court said. The court didn't say there's too much money or too little money. They said, legislature, you've written the definition of basic ed, but you're not paying for it. You're relying on local levies to pay for it. So the only mathematical thing you have to do here is get the state to pick up all the cost of the current basic ed definition. So this is why I've been so cautious for the last year in telling people you could solve a court case and not really see any meaningful change in your schools, and I don't think people are going to tolerate that. I think they expect the system to keep making strides. That's why we want to lay out a vision for something much bigger than the court case.
And Rakedahl has done just that. He's put out a white paper with his vision for the state's schools for at least the next 6 years.
It would be inappropriate to just solve the basic math of this court case and then say everything's great when we still have 21% of our students not graduating on time, tons of jobs not being filled, what I would call kind of a false expectation that every student is headed to universities when we need lots of kids to be excited about lots of things, including the trades and lots of other jobs. So it's really meant to say, what would we do if we could design this system from scratch now that we're starting to invest more significantly in it?
And so you make the case that then there's much harder work of systemically restructuring our K-12 education system in Washington. How would you restructure it?
Well, if you look at sort of what I would argue are the better models around the world. So where are places that are catching us faster than others? You see them doing things that are quite different than the way we practice. They bring in sometimes longer school days and school years, although not always, but generally those systems are at about 1,100 to 1,200 instructional hours a year. We're still using the same 1,000 hours we've used for decades. And one of the things they fill up in that time is they bring universal second language acquisition to every student. We treat second language in this state like it's almost a fault. If you come to us speaking a different language, well, you must learn English in order to succeed in our schools. But we don't tell native English speakers, you know, it's a powerful thing to have a second language. And rather than just have you take 2 years of it in high school to meet a university admissions requirement, let's really get you at least conversant, if not fluent, in the second language, and then our students would be far more globally competitive. It would honor people who come here in immigrant communities, and everyone would have this power of learning dual language. It's a notion, I think, of countries that are beginning to exceed our performance, and we should be doing this. Obviously, we couldn't turn this on tomorrow. There are districts doing it. Some on a limited basis with their own resources. Some are using federal dollars because they do have large immigrant populations, so it's mostly a learning English kind of notion. Some do it with immersion, so they have students learning in a second language their core content, whether it's social studies, math, or science. Some do it by separating students and doing after-school programs. So part of what we have to do here on the policy side is really go mine it for the best practices and scalability. What would it look like to phase this in over time? Because the state wouldn't have that price tag available to them even in 6 years all at once. So there's a big bit of policy work to do, but we laid out the vision to say we got to know where we're going if we're going to start working on the right parts today.
So you've got a pretty ambitious vision. Do you think the consensus is with you in the legislature, within the public schools around the state, or do they not want to do that extra work in order to get us there?
No, I think everyone's ready to keep evolving. I think one of the words that's been sort of overused is reform, as if somebody knows how to do it and everyone else resists it. And I really don't respect that. I think you have a ton of people, mostly in classrooms, who are reforming all the time. They're constantly trying to create better teaching and learning processes. And you have people outside of education who want some big changes. They can't imagine investing billions more and getting the same exact outcomes. And so everyone has an interest here to keep evolving the system and moving it as we become more global and we ask different things of students. So far the embrace has been very positive. People want the detail, though, which is why we didn't say, you know, let's do this tomorrow. We put it in multiple phases so that we can create a very inclusive process over the next several years to get people to weigh in. How would we do this effectively? What kind of resource would it take? How would we phase it? So we don't even think it's appropriate to have every answer today. We just needed to push the large vision so everyone could begin to see, wow, that's an education system that would be remarkably different than it is today. And if they can buy into the vision, they'll work on the detail. And if they work on the detail, they're obligated to pay for it.
So where do you think, I haven't had kids in the public schools for a while. My kids are a lot older. Your kids are much younger. So you get to see it every day. What do the schools do well, and where do you think they most need the help? And I mean sort of on the everyday level.
Uh-huh. Our schools are so remarkably different from when you and I went to school. I guarantee you this. So one of the things is all of the science that they've brought to reading and writing. I know that sounds a little strange, but we know so much more about student development and brain development. So the fact that we're using very critical interim assessments to know where students are in terms of reading and writing, a lot of schools are doing what's called walk to read. So they're identifying students' strengths and they're putting them in groups so that they can excel. That way they're not boring the advancing kids and they're not overstraining the kids who need additional interventions, but they're actually putting them in groups where they can target intervention to where they're at. This is happening in math as well. And, of course, we've brought in lots more science content in the last, I'd say, 5 to 10 years. So our schools on the cognitive side are very transformed. Our teachers are using data like they've never used before. And I'd say the latest innovation and the latest wave is getting our teachers to understand more the social and emotional development of kids so they can understand, hey, this student is struggling in math because there's behavior challenges. And back in the day, we just say, kick the kid out. He's a behavior problem. Today, we know that there's lots potentially behind that. And bringing a kid a targeted intervention for their behavior, their mental health, if you can shore that up, then suddenly we see the student producing a better cognitive outcome. So there's just so much more data and research in our schools than there's ever been.
Is that a good thing necessarily? Sometimes too much data can be overwhelming.
Well, I think it's positive if you give teachers the time to process it and build action plans for individual kids. It's not helpful if you just overwhelm them with data and you don't transform the day at all. Teachers actually need time to process that data, to work in small teams, to create targeted interventions for students. And the state used to pay for this, right? I mean, before the crisis of 2008 and 2009, the state used to pay for professional development for teachers, and now that's almost completely a local decision. And therefore, you had districts who do it really well and districts who don't do it so well. And that's part of the reason we push so hard for a basic ed funding plan that restores significant professional development for our educators.
Chris Rakedahl is Washington State School Superintendent. You can hear several minutes more of our conversation with him on our website. Go to the Inland Journal page. This is the Inland Journal. On January 16th, Spokane City officials and about 100 representatives from 30 community organizations conducted their annual one-day point-in-time census of homeless people. The census is required by the state. The canvassers made contact with 1,090 people. That number's up about 100 from the year before. Of those contacted, about 60% are men. About a fifth are minors. And almost 9 in 10 were living in shelters or transitional housing. There's more demographic information available on the city's website. Despite the increase, Don Kinder believes Spokane is making progress in helping people, especially families, find places to live and stabilize their lives. Kinder directs the City of Spokane's Department of Community, Housing, and Human Services.
In the past 7 to 10 years or so, we have reduced family homelessness by about 60%. We've built, on average, 50 new permanent supportive housing units a year through new construction with Catholic Charities, Volunteers of America, SNAP, and others. The Housing Authority is really at the table with creative ways that we can connect homeless individuals and families with housing vouchers for long-term stability. And we've got some incredible pilots with Priority Spokane around preventing homelessness for school-age children and their families. So I think we're seeing a ton of success. It's not always as highlighted or as visible as the people who are still in crisis, but I think we're moving the needle.
Don Kinder says the city-funded Family Promise Shelter in the Perry District has helped to move about 24 families off the streets into permanent housing so far this year. I asked her what the city gains by doing an annual count of homeless people.
The big win is that we're able to then cater and adapt our homeless services to best meet the needs of that population. So if we see spikes in certain types of homelessness, whether it's sheltered, unsheltered, families, singles, young people, we can adjust our services in the community to better meet that need. It also allows us to really think about our outreach teams. So if we're seeing a big change, this year was a baseline for the youth count. We counted 203 people under the age of 18, I think is what it says. And that's a huge indicator to us that we need to be providing really robust services for both unaccompanied minors and youth and families. So, you know, one thing we've done is we have a 24/7 family shelter currently in operation through Family Promise. They're sleeping 60 to 70 people a night. On June 8th, they slept 66 individuals, even this time of year when it's nice out. So we're certainly able to, the data that we collect through the point in time count allows us to really inform practices and services to better meet what we're seeing. It also helps us better plan strategically for the long term. So if what we're seeing steadily is that homeless population number is increasing, it helps us think about things like, do we need to target better job training, wage growth, more affordable housing units? What are those long-term solutions in addition to the, do we need more shelter space and meal sites, but also how do we prevent this from growing?
So because of what happened, from what you found out from that January count, have you already started to adjust things?
So we have a big push right now around the youth count. So we've got a 100-day challenge currently about just halfway underway to end youth homelessness, and that's targeting youth who are 13 to 24. We're proving to be very successful. As of day 36, we had housed 30 young people, many of whom had children of their own or were pregnant, and so we're really targeting that population. We also have an initiative underway called Invest Health that's seeking to create two new housing projects that are not yet in existence for our community to serve that age range. So we're certainly seeing some changes on the youth front. We've made some big changes in our youth committees of our boards, and we created a new youth advisory board that's made up of young people who've experienced homelessness, particularly to gain real direct life experience. On the single side, we really attribute that increase to the existence of a 24/7 shelter that was in operation at House of Charities, so people who otherwise would not have had a place inside a shelter because capacity would have been reached, or who may have just chosen to camp outdoors in a less harsh winter, we're coming inside. So the beauty in that is that we are able to then know who those folks are in our system. And now we know that shelter capacity is very much needed. Had those extra 150 beds not been there, I'm not sure we would have been able to find those 150 people in the community unsheltered. And so it does help us understand that we do have a need for increased shelter capacity. And so we are working very hard to relaunch that effort.
Looking ahead, the city is watching closely the debate over the new federal budget with an eye on proposed cuts to social service programs.
But I think our biggest push right now is to really make sure that we're targeting those subpopulations that we know can be less visible, which includes a lot of young people, families, women who don't have as much shelter capacity in our community as men do, and then really getting out into the schools and other places where homeless families or individuals might present that are not going to be in the homeless system. We know we have a large population that does things like couch surfing, the people that utilize the system. And so how do we get better about counting those folks who have a safe place to be tonight but not tomorrow? And so our committees and our continuum of care board are working really hard to process how do we continue to improve this. So I think the point in time counts an ever-evolving effort.
Don Kinder directs the City of Spokane's Department of Community, Housing, and Human Services. The next point-in-time count will be done next January. Today, members of several Northwest Indian tribes are in Kettle Falls to celebrate the traditional role of salmon in their culture. It's the second consecutive year such an event has been held. Some of the celebrants arrived in huge hand-carved canoes. They set off from the Keenly Side Dam near Castlegar, British Columbia, paddled down the Columbia River, and arrived for a ceremony at the site of one of the most historically prolific fisheries in the Northwest. That fishery disappeared with the building of Grand Coulee Dam in the 1930s and the creation of its reservoir, Lake Roosevelt.
You know, for over 80 years, there's the development of Grand Coulee. They had the ceremony of tears here, and we basically kind of lost that part of our culture and our ceremonies. So these canoes are a way of waking that up, so to speak, to get back out on the water together as tribes to work to protect and enhance these, you know, these resources for the benefit of all people.
D.R. Michel is the executive director of the Upper Columbia United Tribes. He's an enrolled member of the Colville Confederated Tribes, and he's on the phone with us from Kettle Falls. So tell me about last year's event.
All of the tribes, the Coeur d'Alenes, Kalispels, Kootenays, Colville, Spokanes, it was just a very moving and emotional experience to hear people talk about how these canoes made them feel, just working on them or just being around them, had awakened something in us. some of the people said those working on that canoe or being in it has changed their lives.
Do you anticipate this becoming an annual event beyond this year?
The salmon ceremony is an annual event. The canoes, basically, they're kind of been taken over by families within those member tribes. So those journeys and those things will kind of be handed off to them. There'll be canoe journeys and things continuing on. We're just not exactly sure about, you know, how they tie into the salmon ceremony here.
I'm told there's an effort to reintroduce salmon from the Canada side. Is that correct?
Well, it's to reintroduce salmon back into Canada. We got to get them over Chief Joseph Dam and Grand Coulee Dam, and that's been a big initiative for the tribes. We never did really surrender, so to speak, to the loss of those salmon. We've always in the back of our minds wondering how and when those salmon would come home. And with some Columbia River Treaty, the Northwest Power and Conservation Council's program, and some new technologies has provided us with some opportunities to do the feasibility of bringing the salmon back up above Grand Coulee into the headwaters in Canada. It's a big project that the tribes are working on to bring them home.
Something you think you'll see in your lifetime?
Yeah, in my lifetime, in our lifetime, I think we'll see salmon above Coulee Dam in some form, maybe not, directly tied to big passage facilities or along that line, but there will be salmon above Coulee. It's not a matter of if, it's just when.
And then you'll have fishermen again.
Yeah, and again, those are not just tribal issues. Those opportunities are there for everybody, and I think that's one aspect of this whole system, the Columbia River Treaty, is that initial focus, our original focus of the treaty was specific to flood risk management and hydro production. And folks tend to look at the economics of only those two legs of the stool. We've been working real hard to help folks understand that there's another leg to that stool, and that's the health of the environment and providing those opportunities on that end. There's huge economic opportunities with the return of the salmon and floodplain management. And, we pay a lot of money as ratepayers and taxpayers to protect a lot of these developments in floodplains. And so there's a whole other side of this process that needs to be looked at and needs to be incorporated in a modernized treaty. The economics of an ecosystem are a healthy, functioning river system with salmon is huge economic opportunities.
That's D.R. Michel, the executive director of the Upper Columbia United Tribes. In addition to today's event in Kettle Falls, another salmon ceremony is planned for tomorrow morning in Castlegar. Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. It's heard every Thursday at 5 p.m. here on KSFC. You can listen for our full programs or our individual stories online anytime. Go to the Inland Journal page. Thanks for joining us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.